Dave Rattigan.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you. It's nice to be here. The last time I was here, we were talking about it. I just filmed a commercial, which is now shown on the Red Sox games. I don't know if you've seen it. I'm in a cab with Heidi Watney. Okay. Apparently, three of you have seen it. That's good. For those of you who aren't, we'll start at the beginning. The Red Sox are a baseball team. They play in Boston. And Heidi Watney, if you don't know her, she's the field reporter for the Red Sox. Very pretty and very nice. People always say she's nice, and she's very nice. In fact, during the filming, she actually signed a baseball, and she wrote a little something for my little son, Kevin. And the ironic thing is, I don't have a little son, Kevin. I do have a 53-year-old friend, Kevin. And he has a baseball that says, "To Kevin, a great big boy, Heidi Watney."
Where to, pal?
Financial District.
You got it. Heidi Watney.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this cab taken?
Absolutely not.
But I was here first.
Not the way I saw it, buddy.
But I have an important meeting across town.
Look, buddy, it's a nice day for a walk. There's an Olympia Sports right there. They're having a big sale. Go get yourself a new pair of sneakers and hit the bricks.
Unbelievable.
Sorry.
Now at Olympia Sports, buy one pair of shoes, get the second pair half price. See store for details.
To the ballpark, Miss Watney?
Hello, and welcome to Carnival Personnel Sideshow. I'm Jacques.
I'm Joe.
And Joe, again, we talk about it all the time, how spoiled we are in this region for the number of amazing comedians, the number of great shows. And again, we have just a staple of New England comedy for at least 3+ decades. And I've had the absolute, you know, privilege of getting to do a number of shows for this guy. So I won't waste anybody more time, and we'll just say welcome to Mr. Dave Rattigan.
Hey, how you doing?
So let's get right into it. Dave, why did you get into comedy? What made you think you could get up on stage one day and do this? And did you wet yourself the first time you tried?
Did not wet myself the first time I tried. But the reason I got into it was because I always wanted to do it. And I was 36 years old and I got divorced. And my life was at a low point. And I thought, you know, I might as well try this now.
I don't think I've heard an origin story I love more.
I love how, like, it's like, I've hit rock bottom. It's time to do stand up.
Yeah, basically. Well, it was a lot better than the other activities that I was, I was basically out drinking a lot. And I thought, this is not healthy. So I'll try stand up. Little did I know how unhealthy that is. The idea was just to do it one or two times, but I was good at it. People came up and they offered me this and they offered me that. And then I passed at the Comedy Connection pretty early. And before I knew that I couldn't succeed in this business because I was too old, I was making too much money to stop. So it's a very, very strange situation. Not that I'm making a lot of money, but it's I was kind of committed to it financially.
And it is such a cliche, but was this akin to going to therapy? Instead of going to therapy and working stuff out, did you figure your life out while you were figuring out how to be a comic?
No. Okay. No. Are you nuts?
Why you think stand-up is fucking therapy.
You know something?
And he's cheap, by the way. He won't get real therapy. He'll just do stand-up.
Is that really what you're doing, Jack?
Yeah, 100%. 100. We were supposed to move back to L.A. Pandemic, you know, sidebarred it. I was bored out of my mind. I have a great career and thing there, and I was just running out of stuff to do. So I said, I haven't done this since the 90s. I'll just do that to have something to do. And it's been just something to do that has turned into the most fun midlife crisis cry for help you can possibly imagine. Who gets back into this at 53?
That's probably true. And you don't have to worry about getting body checked like you would if you went into no check hockey.
I played hockey around the globe. I was coaching the Qatari national team in 2016. I played on the same team in LA. The problem is I can't play hockey back here because there's no such thing as no check hockey here. And I have the shortest fuse. And so one time I get cross-checked from behind. I don't want to be in fights anymore at 50. But every time I try to play a pickup here, I think I get 3 or 4 shifts before somebody does something so insanely dumb that I'm like, I have to leave before I pound somebody's head through the glass. So I just stopped.
You know who used to say stuff like this? They were doing this to me. They were doing this to me. They're all bigger than me. Was Kenny Linsman for the Boston Bruins.
The Rat. The Rat. He was one. The best.
Fearing an opponent.
Yeah.
What's that?
He was like, because I'm a small guy. Well, I was a small guy. I was playing juniors at 5'7", you know, 145 pounds. It was Kenny Linsman that I loved. It was Claude Lemieux. The biggest assholes were the guys I mirror my game after. But I don't want to do that. I want to just go and play. But do you skate? Are you a hockey guy?
I was a pickup player back when I was young. And a lot of my friends who I played with were in that 5'7", 5'8", range or 5'6". And they all said the same thing. We're picked on. We're picked on. They started it. And then they would get into fights. And, you know, in Lisbon's case, we know what he did. It was, but it's always about defense. And you're right about pickup. You're right about no-check hockey. No-check hockey. I played in a Czech league one summer. And immediately I noticed how much cleaner it was than the no-check league.
100%. Right. Because yeah. You're expecting it, the heads up. But it's funny because one of the many really fun things about falling down into this rabbit hole, we had Jim Colton on a few months ago, and I see a hockey jersey behind him while we're Zooming, and I'm like, oh, do you play? And he goes, yeah, I played here, and blah, blah, blah. I went to Fitchburg State in 89 to play hockey, but I didn't make the team, and I'm like, oh. And it was just silent for about 20 seconds. And I'm like, I went to Fitchburg in 89 to play hockey, and I made the team. I just felt bad, you know.
After him, did he get cut from hockey?
Yeah, but it's so funny. We went to the same school at the same time. I don't know how we never crossed paths because Fitchburg is tiny. I mean, absolutely tiny. And then, you know, I fall back into this and you know, I get to know Steve Bjork a bit. And I'm like, we moved from Wilmington to Andover. And like 84, had we stayed, he would have graduated with my sister. I mean, it's such a tiny world. But I want to get back to comedy. So you're 36. You say, I'm going to do it. Did you take classes or did you just go a few times? How did you make that transition?
I did. And just to jump back to your point about it being therapeutic, I don't know that it's therapeutic, but I will say this. And I learned this when I went to New York and I got just killed in New York. I just got just rejected and rejected and rejected. And, but I realized how much fun it is to do. I mean, when you're on stage for that half hour or 20 minutes or 45 minutes or 10 minutes, whatever time you get, and it's working, you're in the zone. And of course, having played some sports, I did have that as a you know, the parallels between being in that really good game. I was a goalie. So let's say 2 minutes left in the game, swarming your net, you're holding on to a lead. You're just in that zone, and that's really fun. Playing baseball, same deal, close game, in the field, whatever, or any of that stuff is definitely a parallel between that, for me at least, and a really good stand-up set.
Yeah, no, it's there are nights where you drive home and you're like, I want to go find someplace else to go do this. It was such a good thing that you want to. Is there an open mic at 1:30 a.m. in Natick I can get you, because you want to keep that going?
Yeah. So my origin story goes like this. I actually was I was married and I was divorced very suddenly, and it was in between my wife had given it to me as a gift.
The divorce?
So divorce?
That's not the gift, although maybe it was. But no, she gave me as a gift a comedy class with Dave Fitzgerald, late Dave Fitzgerald, who was a great comedian, really good guy. And I went to one of the classes, and then all of a sudden, like I said, I had a very sudden divorce, and it occurred between the first and the second class. I didn't go to the second class. It was done for that period. Or for that class. And so a few months later, I was in my spiral, and I thought, well, maybe I'll try it again. I was living in Somerville in Davis Square, and I saw something at Cambridge Center for Adult Ed with Bob Gautreaux. So I took Bob's class, and it was a struggle to get up on stage and get in front of people. But once I did, it was good. People laughed. And so I actually went back to Dave Fitzgerald afterwards and kind of explained what happened. And he said, why don't you meet me? I'm going to be at the Comedy Connection. So we went to the Comedy Connection and he spent an hour with me to kind of help me out. And and that's how I started. And my very first night on stage, somebody came up to me and said, you want to come to my open mic? And then somebody else came up to me and said, I need an opener. You want to come? And I was on the way to the ruination of the rest of my life because of the comedian.
So you were like easy pass. Like you just kind of got right into the fast lane, like no tolls, no stopping.
Yeah. And then, a certain point, what would happen is I had a really good 5 minutes. And then I would go place and they would say, do 15. So people were in for a really terrible 10 minutes, a decent five. And I remember one time I bombed really hard for 20 minutes. And in the middle, I got an applause break because they liked one bit. I took a nasty beating for a while.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that a lot of people really have the trouble making their transition, like the 5 to 10, the 10 to the 15, and I'm honest about it. I got into this late. I'm not going to get my 10,000 hours in. I have absolutely no desire to put in the work to be a headliner. Like I'm never, I don't even like to stand up for 45 minutes when I'm waiting in line for a ride at Disney, let alone how much energy that you need to keep that going. But yeah, when you were developing as a comic, how did you go from the 5 to the 20 and fill that material? Like, what was your process? Or was it just, the more you did it, the more comfortable you got?
I just kept writing. I kept writing and I would go to the Comedy Connection. I passed at the Comedy Connection. When I started, they had not been bringing in new comics for a couple of years. So what they decided to do was to hold multiple nights of tryouts, and they would do 15 comics a night. So out of 150 comics, I think they passed like 10 or 12. And I was in that group. It was only my 15th time on stage. So I would go places and it would be like, oh, he's passed at the Comedy Connection. So I would get the last set and the long set, which was always a mistake.
Yeah.
And so I just wrote and wrote and wrote. So I'd go to the Connection. I'd go to Dick Doherty's place. I'd go to whatever open mic would have me. And I would just try and just write big hunks of stuff. And it took a while. It took a while. And like I said, I took a little beating.
Were there any great mentors along the way?
Yeah, I'd say there were probably a handful, guys who either mentored or just were friends and helpful friends. Certainly Paul D'Angelo was one, Dave Fitzgerald, as I mentioned, the late Dave Fitzgerald, and Bob Gautreau were both mentors for me. And then I've developed, I don't want to leave anybody out. I'm sure there were others. If you're good, if people think you're good, they're going to give you advice. If you take the advice, they'll give you more advice. I mean, I get this now. I get it all the time. People ask me for advice. If I give them advice and they don't take it or they don't seem receptive, that's good. That's going to save me a lot of time in the future.
No, it's been, and then at what point did you say, I'm going to do my own shows?
I got to mention this too, by the way. Jimmy Dunn's been very helpful to me, which I got to mention because I don't want to not mention anybody. And I'm sure I'm gonna about 9 or 10 others. Gary Gulman was pretty helpful although he was still, mm-hmm. He was only a few years ahead of me. That's one thing. And Dick Doherty actually gave me great advice. He said that in this business, there's always somebody right ahead of you on the rung, a rung higher than you. And the idea is to hook up with that person and take that person's advice. And that person might say, come this play, come here, come here, come here. And you'll for stage time and you'll kind of get better and you won't jump way ahead, which is what a lot of people do. I get people on their first open mic that will tell me, when do I start getting paid work? When do I start to headline? And I give them the same old spiel. And then they tell me how different they are. Oh, I'm different than everybody else. I'm ready to hop in right now. And I say, so are a lot of other people, maybe 100. So, well,
I have found that to be, there's so many guys just in the last year, you know, that have said X, Y, Z, and I've taken it all to heart, and now I get to call these guys, you know, my friends, but every chance I get for somebody to say, hey, from little things like, you know, you hold the mic like this, maybe do this, or like just fine tune. And the way I look at it, if somebody like that, who maybe 2-3 years ago, I'd be paying and driving, you know, a half hour to go see when we come back to the region to visit, is now giving me advice, why wouldn't I stop what I'm doing and just really take it to heart?
You'd be surprised. And it's pretty it's about new comedians and open mic comedians is that they're all different. Like somebody had been away from comedy for a while and then they came back to an open mic. And then afterwards they just said to me, they said, you know, a lot of the faces are different, but they're still all the same. Right. And that is that there are different types, or some people just are going to, you can see that they might get there. And then others, you might say they're funny, but they're not going to get there. Or you have some who are neither, and they're just delusional. And I'm sure there are people in between, a lot of people in between, but anyway, so what were you asking?
No,
actually, I have a question about the Dick Doherty advice. How many dick bucks did he charge you for that advice?
I have some dick bucks somewhere.
Do you awesome. Really?
I kept them as a souvenir in a folder. It's I'm sure it's never going to be found, but yeah.
I implore you to go look for it, because like one of our favorite things to talk to comedians who are, you know, over 40 who've done shows or run shows for him. I will never tire for the Dick Doherty stories and the whole history of Dick Bucks and what was called the Lighthouse. Was that the place that got put out of business?
I don't know. When I got my Dick Bucks, I think he was doing it at the vault. I think he was doing it at the vault. Okay. Which was in Boston. So that before the Lighthouse was before my time. Dick was, it's certainly, I was just talking with somebody recently about all the people that, and again, if you, the late great Dick Doherty, he fired me.
Well, he was like the George Steinbrenner of Boston comedy. I mean, everybody, if you didn't get fired by Dick Doherty in the 80s and 90s, you weren't in comedy in Boston. That was basically it.
That's an excellent point. That's like, I was going to list it. Dane Cook, yeah. Gary Gulman. I remember Gary Gulman. I was going to actually look this up for this interview, but I forgot. But he did an open. We did a Dick Doherty showcase in Salem, and Gary had been fired by Dick, but he just, you know, he showed up and he says, introduce me as, and he gave me a name, and it was the name of Peter Brady's alter ego.
Johnny Bravo.
Oh, that's Greg Brady. Yeah, Johnny Greg Bravo.
Johnny, he fit the suit.
No, it wasn't Johnny Bravo. It was Johnny Bravo, I'd remember, because he fit the suit.
Yeah. Oh, right.
But apparently Peter Brady had an alter ego as well.
Oh, I read that. Oh, wow. He did.
And oh, yeah, man. If you guys can come up with that, that's great. But I won't remember it. I won't remember it. I just introduced Gary and I just thought it was funny, and he went up and he had a great set. And but it was a you know, that was just, Dick did a lot of good for a lot of people. He did. He taught us all to confirm shows. He taught many of us to, you know, to do your time, be a comedian. You know, don't lose it. Don't lose it on the audience. You know, be professional. All of those things. And there's nobody right now who does that in Boston. So I think it's too bad, because it would be, as much as Dick had a couple of faults, one or two. Incredibly cheap, but you know, that's part of the business. But he really did teach a lot of people how to be a comedian.
Yeah.
Well, the funny thing about getting fired by Dick, like Joe said, are you in comedy if you didn't get fired? But my favorite Dick Doherty stories is people. Yeah, you know, I think it was to Tony V a few weeks ago. We were talking to. He got fired by Dick, and then about 4 days later got a call saying, okay, here are the shows I have coming up that I need you for. It's like, you just fired me. He goes, that was last week, Tony. Anyways, I need, like, it never happened. Like, you know, it just, it's like, oh, but those stories are my favorite. So when did you say, I'm going to be a Dick Doherty, I'm going to produce shows?
Oh, I did it pretty early. I had done it when I was in college for rock bands. And somebody wanted to do something at Pizzeria Regina, or maybe they told, they, I guess they told me the Pizzeria Regina in Brooklyn wanted to do comedy. So not knowing anything at all, like not knowing that you don't do an open mic on a Friday or a Saturday, I went and I did. It wasn't an open mic. It was a showcase, which meant that I was getting the best open micers. And I got good guys. I mean, I got Dwayne Perkins, who did a lot of Tonight shows. I got Gary Gulman, who's great. I got a lot of guys who headlined, who'd have a gig in the area and swing by on the way by just because they were good guys and it was a fun hang. And so we did that for a long time. And then they had a sister restaurant, Bel Canto, and it lasted for about a year, year and a half. Then my daughter, in 2005, my daughter was born. And my choice as a comedian was to either go on the road and try to make money on the road or make or book shows. So that's when I really made the choice to book a lot, you know, to, and I don't know that I'm a Dick Doherty, but sometimes I feel like it, you know, when I don't pay guys or pay really small amounts of money. But I started to do just fundraisers and other shows around 2005, just because I thought it was a way to stay home with my family. I'd waited a long time to have children, and I had one, and I just wanted to kind of preserve that. That didn't work out, as it turned out. I mean, I still have a child. I don't have a wife. I don't have that wife. I've been divorced so many times, I can't tell you how many, but I still get the company. And, you know, that's been interesting.
And like a Dick Doherty, you'll have more than one show going on a Friday night, on a Saturday night. How over the years have you managed? I mean, you go from I'm working on my comedy to I'm now running a business and I have to have managers and lieutenants under me because I can't be doing a show here headlining and running that show. And
it's an absolutely horrible idea to book shows. It's, I mean, to book one or two shows is one thing, but to book like I do is horrible because you don't make enough money. Is all the money in the world can't bring your blood pressure back to normal. I don't know. It's I would say this. I don't really relax until Sunday. And then even then I'm worried that I'm going to get a call on Monday saying, hey, how come my comedians never showed up?
Yeah.
Or I leave the house on Friday for a gig for somebody else. And I'm driving there and I'm thinking, am I supposed to bring the sound? Was I supposed to do this? Was I supposed to do that? So that's kind of the, it's definitely a double-edged sword. It's nice to be able to give people work. It's nice to be able to, you know, jump on shows if you're not working somewhere else. But it's, you know, I looking back on it, I would love to be the guy who just showed up, made the X amount of dollars, and then went home.
Yeah, because, I mean, I've seen that there's only... Every time you turn around, I mean, there's not an oversaturation because there are so many great shows within an hour drive of anywhere, whether you're in Boston, Lowell, you know, Manchester. There's so many great shows at the clubs and then at the restaurants and then at the VFWs and stuff like that. But I see only so many people making all those shows happen. And that's a world I wouldn't even want to think about getting into it. There was a little while back, a friend had a place and said, oh, they're thinking about doing something. Joe and I have run some fundraisers. I've produced movies and stuff like that. But it's like, no, I don't want to get into this. So when I got approached, I said, I know some people. Let me sit down at the table. Let me get a couple people at the table. And then leaving the meeting, hey, you put this together. What do you want out of this? I'm like, nothing. If it works out, I hope I'll come to a couple of shows. I'll host a couple of shows. But as far as that apparatus, I wish everybody the best of health and happiness. I wouldn't want to do what you do because I don't want to work that hard. I don't.
Yeah, it's definitely a double-edged sword. It's if you want to get into comedy for the fun, just be a comic. Just be a comic. Show up on time. Be friendly, talk to the comics in the back of the room, let your friends, you know, let people know that you're going to be somewhere, so they might come to your show, because that's always helpful for a young comic. And keep writing and keep being funny, because it's just a lot more fun to be that person who shows up and does jokes and leaves.
Do you get to write much? How much time do you get to work on newer stuff?
Write about 10 minutes a year. I mean, I write more than that, and I discard a lot of it, but I write about 10 minutes a year, 10 new minutes a year, which is good for Boston.
No, it's fantastic. What is your favorite? Do you like the hosting? What is the part of the performance that you like the most? What is the, I would do this for free forever if I could?
Well, I would love to be the guy that goes last every show, because that means I would get the most money. The spot on the show, the little cushy spot right in the middle.
Yeah.
After they were already warmed up. You go on, you do a half an hour, and they all think you're the greatest thing in the world. And then the guy after you or the woman after you has got to be better, because they expect that person to be great. I like that spot, the soft spot, which is the middle. But I think everybody does. Don't you?
No, it's funny, because when my wife and I were living overseas with our kids in 2014, my sister, you know, our weekly phone call, she's like, I just found your next favorite comedian. And it was Steve Bjork, who had come to her library for a book signing. And so the next time we came to town, I went to see him, and I'm like, oh my God, because I love Brian Regan
He came to do a book signing.
Oh, a book reading. Yeah. He put out a book. It was a collection of short stories.
Yeah. It was my daughter's favorite book. Oh. She probably shouldn't have been reading it, but she was too young. But so what library was he at?
The Wilmington Library, the Wilmington Public Library. And so when the next time I came home to visit, we went and we saw him. Over the past 3-4 months, I've seen him be that middle guy. And just the look of how relaxed he is, not having to carry the show. So he was the middle guy with Christine Hurley just a little while ago. I saw in Chelmsford. In Boston, he was the middle guy with Chris Zito at Guy Fieri's place. And this is a guy who headlined, but, you know, he doesn't have to carry the weight. You know what I mean? And it just seems like, yeah, that's the kind of place where if you don't have the ego that has to have the name on the top of the marquee, it's a pretty fun place to be, I would guess.
And one of the other things that you notice, at least in Boston, I assume it's everywhere, money aside, if money is not part of the equation, the guys who have headlined for a while, they're fine with going earlier in the show.
Yeah.
Guys on the way up, they all want to, like, I want to go as late as I can in the show and all that. And the guys who've already been there are like, yeah, I'll go in the middle. That's fine.
The other thing I've noticed, I've got to, you know, do a few of these Smitty shows in Maine. And, mm-hmm. and some of the headline comics, they try to negotiate. Hey, do you want to do an extra 5? Hey, you want to do an extra? And if they can get under 30, if they can do 30 as the headliner, they could not be happier. it's so fun. And then you got the 7-minute guy who's like, oh, I'll do 12 minutes. And you got the 12-minute guy like, oh, I love to do, you know, 15 minutes type thing. But they, you know, they're going to get paid the same amount if they're doing 30, they're doing 45. And they would like to do the middle, but you know, when you're doing one of those shows and your name is the top of the ticket, you kind of can't.
Right.
You know, people want to see that. So how did you survive through the pandemic? How did you keep comedy going?
Well, I got money from the SBA and Small Business Association. I couldn't take, because I have another career. I'm a college professor. So I couldn't get, I made enough and I, college professor, I'm an adjunct. So I was still getting paid as an adjunct because I was teaching online and I hate Zoom. But anyway, so I was teaching online and so I couldn't get the $1,000, whatever it was, the stimulus checks. But I got a couple of loans from the SBA and a couple of grants, and that kind of kept me afloat. However, my part of the bargain was that I had to keep running shows. So I was doing parking lot shows, I was doing outdoor shows. I moved in, you know, when we could move in, we'd move in. And, you know, we had multiple microphones for every show. We had little covers that we would put on the mics for each comedian. We had a lot of hand sanitizer. And the only people that I noticed who got sick among the comedians were the people who were really sloppy about, you know, but, you know, the ones who would come up and talk to you forever and try and hug you and all that crap. Mm,
right.
Those are the people that got sick. So we were really fortunate that we all took it seriously when we did have shows outdoors. But I don't know if you ever did a show in a parking lot. But,
I got onto the bandwagon after sanity kind of resumed and life came somewhat normal.
Yeah,
but
it's too bad. I think everybody should do a show in a parking lot. I had done shows in parking lots before then, so I kind of knew what to expect.
Jacques, you could still do a parking lot show. Just go to Market Basket at like noontime on a Saturday.
Bring my little. Did any of the venues you had shows going with not make it through the pandemic?
Yeah, a couple. It's sad, you know, people and I don't know why. The SBA was really helpful for me. I don't know how they. I know some people that they couldn't get it because of either they were making too much money in another area or something. You know, there's somebody, I know one person, he had a place on kind of an umbrella, and he was doing well in his other businesses, or the other businesses were still going, because there were businesses that did well during the pandemic.
But, like the hand sanitizer business.
Yeah, the hand sanitizer business, but like tree care, carpentry, things like that, outdoor stuff.
Yeah,
they went well. The mask business boomed.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Etsy was a big winner, I think, for
yeah. Etsy, I don't know. I got a theory, which is basically if you look at who did well, it's the deliver your food at home businesses, the supermarkets, the Amazon and television, you know, and I think Amazon Prime. So I think it was Jeff Bezos.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. No, 100%. I've not heard that theory specifically, but I'm pushing all my chips in the center of the table.
Yeah, that.
You know,
they turned our world upside down, and now none of us can eat bats.
You know, I try to have nice things in this world, and the man just takes it away from you.
It's terrible. And, so have you ever done a show in a parking lot?
I was in a band in the early 90s, and we did some shows, and it's like, why are we outside, you know? Yeah. Not specifically in a parking lot, but you'd be like, oh, this is happening, it'd be a college thing. It's like, oh, you're gonna play at this college quad? And it's like, no. It's like, you know, as a drummer, it's like, and now there's people walking behind you when you're a drummer. It's like, why is there anybody standing behind me? It's like, it was not great.
I gained a new appreciation of what musicians go through when I started doing comedy, particularly the bar shows where everyone's just talking and you're just interrupting their piece. And I thought, how can singers or I could see how a drummer could power through, but I don't know how a singer could actually remember the words, remember the beat, the melody, all that when there's just so much din, but they do. Joe, how about you? What have you done in the parking lot?
Oh, I don't think we could talk about it on the podcast, but I mean, as far as comedy, I'm not a stand-up. I'm a sit-down, stay in the corner, keep my mouth shut kind of guy. I kind of help Jacques with a couple of jokes here and there, but I'm not a performer.
You've never done anything in a parking lot?
No parking lot shows. I've cried myself after, you know, silently in a car after a show that I've done, but that's about the extent of my comedy in a parking lot.
Well, when Joe was a teenager, he dabbled in this, and of course, his first show was a Dick Doherty show.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it was like a showcase thing. I had a connection, a friend of a friend kind of thing, and yeah, I got on there, I did my bad Gilbert Gottfried impersonation, and then that... that bought me a minute, and then a minute of Gilbert Gottfried goes a long way. But then, yeah, after that, I just sort of fizzled out, you know.
Here's my favorite Joe doing comedy story. Joe and I happened to be friends. We did a little cable comedy show that I ended up getting on a UHF channel in Los Angeles. And so Joe was back here. He was starting this, and my parents love Joe, and they go to see one of Joe's shows. Now, I want to preface
Dick Doherty show.
It was a Dick Doherty show, and I want to preface by saying my parents are not cheap people. They're actually great philanthropists. But Joe, why don't you tell them what happened with my parents?
Well, they're not cheap, but they certainly are drunks. And what they did...
Yes, they were drunk. Yes.
They ordered a little too much Wowie sauce, and they left, I think, assuming that the comics would cover the tip or like the actual payment. And so I get approached after the show saying, hey, do you know these two people that were here, like gone, not like as in not here now? And I go, yeah. And they go, yeah, well, they bought like four drinks or something, so you owe for these drinks. And I'm like, oh, okay, I guess I'll take it out of my dick bucks. Oh wait, those don't apply here. Here's real money. And so that was that.
And you're 18, you're 18, 19?
Yeah, I couldn't even, right, I'm buying drinks and I can't even legally buy drinks.
Now, I gotta say, my dad, rocket scientist, that's not an exaggeration, you know, a renowned physicist. Rocket. Yeah, I mean, he worked his whole, I mean, he was one of those guys, he tried to retire 20 years before he retired, but every time he would retire from like Textron, he would get a call saying, hey, we have this project, we need you to do this type thing. And he loved it. But yeah, my parents, are you saying
that every time he'd try to get out, that pull him back in?
100%. And they got a dog. They don't drink like that anymore. They can't. They're 85 and 81. But my mom got a dog that's a love of her life about 2 years ago and named it Cosmo. It was like that was their thing. They were the classic, you know, they're home from work. They would have a drink, make dinner, have a drink, and go. And they still do. They still go dancing 3 or 4 nights a week. But yeah, they weren't being cheap. They literally just – well, I did the Uber home that night show, do you think?
I don't think Uber was a thing back
Uber
then.
Uber wasn't a thing back then. That was back in the good old days when you drink and drive.
That's it. Or teleporting, as Jacques puts it.
You know, I'm just sitting here and I'm thinking about this. Sounds like very successful 85-year-old guy and with his wife, and they're respectable. And you two guys are talking about their drunken night back in the 90s.
Oh. Got to take them down a notch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
they think they're so smart because he's probably thinking to himself, remember that time we stopped Joe?
Every chance they get, they see me and they recognize me as the guy that they stiffed in 1997.
Did they reimburse you?
With many dinners. Yeah, okay. You know, yeah. I've been to their house many times for holiday dinners. They're lovely folks. They're, you know, they let the night get away from them. That's all.
Yeah. That means no. If you were a good friend, Jack, you would have shaken him down.
He probably did.
He probably palmed the money.
That's it.
I got to tell you this. I would, Dave, but my mother's Everett tough. Right now, you know, I don't, it's funny because I was talking with my son, you know, 16, all shoulders, played high school football. And we were recently talking and I said, I forget how it came up. And I'm like, my mom, blah, blah, blah. I said, would you want Grammy to be mad at you? He was like, no. I said, all honestly, Grayson, do you think right now, if you had to, you could take Grammy? And she's like, and he thinks about it. He's like, I don't think so. Like, I don't think so. But back to your comedy. So you come out of the pandemic, things are starting. How did you go about finding
back to my comedy? All right.
Yeah. Well, no.
Do your parents listen to the podcast?
It is surprising how often, because like we've had, you know, my dad has a protege who I refer to as my older brother. He's my stepdad. He came in the picture when I was 12. He had this guy who was like 18 or 19 who worked under him during the summer, who was skipped the 7th grade and the 9th grade and still was valedictorian at this private Jewish high school in Baltimore. And so now he's a tenured professor. So, yeah, sometimes we have comics on. A couple weeks ago, we had the NHL Players Association Elite Legal Counsel. So we had, you know, a mentor of mine who created Legendary Pictures. So my parents are always the problem is when my mom listens, she's like, why aren't you working for him? why don't you do this? Like, we have these crazy, we've had a couple, I don't know if John Hirschick's a billionaire yet, but we have a friend who sold one company in the early 90s for 310. He sold his last company about 5 years ago for 450. He's a tech guy, and he's a really, really close friend. My wife was just in his son's wedding about 6 months ago. And my mom's always like, every time we have somebody like that on and she listens, like, you know so many smart people. Why aren't you working for them? I'm like, because I don't want to.
Even now at 53, she's telling him to get a job. Yeah, basically. Exactly. It's just like, why aren't you working?
She's finally stopped asking me when I'm cutting my hair. Like, I started growing out my hair when I was 16, and one of my boys just cut his hair because he plays soccer and it was in his face, but the other one has hair. Literally, Dave, I can't tell if it's 74 Robert Plant or 83 David Lee Roth, but it's a mane. It goes out and down his back. You literally can't pay him to cut his hair. My mother has tried for years, but he just
literally tried to pay him.
She has not offered enough cash.
Tell
her to bring it up. Tell her to take that money that she didn't pay Dick Doherty
or me.
Yeah, you, Joe.
Yeah, compounded interest. Let's get the calculator.
Oh, listen, if they put it into the market, they did very well.
So, hey, before we get off, you work in higher education. What are you teaching, or what have you taught?
I teach communication.
Okay, but fantastic.
Sometimes I teach mass communication. Sometimes I teach public speaking.
Oh, my wife was an adjunct professor at a college, and she taught public speaking.
Where?
Emmanuel. But no longer, because... We also need to go get a job and make money. So,
yeah, that's the problem with adjunct teaching. I like it. I mean, I like it because you're hanging around kids and they're at that age where you don't have to deal with their parents. They're a little more responsible. Their brains are kind of developing in a good way.
I think she enjoyed the job. It's just that, financially, it was kind of like we were getting paid in dick bucks, basically. And it was like, I have to pay bills.
Yeah, it's an interesting profession to get into, because you see, I do three state schools. So state schools pay pretty well, but I've been offered teaching positions at other places. That's like, you're paying what?
Right.
So I don't know where Emmanuel sits in that thing. But
they're basically like, let's adjunct the F out of this stuff and then not pay anybody.
Well, she took what she made. I think it was like last year or the year before, calculated the hours, and she qualified to get a passport as being a Guatemalan national. Like, they it worked, because unfortunately Joe's wife, what's that word? Cares. So she put so many hours into it that you just couldn't make it. It made no sense after.
Right. It was. She also did like the was part of like the drama department kind of thing. So she did like a lot of like theater stuff afterwards that was outside of the curriculum kind of. So
yeah,
that can
lead to shrinking paycheck.
Basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. She lost money on each deal, but made up for it in volume.
When she dies, she's going to achieve total enlightenment, which is nice.
So, have you tried stand-up comedy?
I'm sorry?
Have you tried stand-up comedy? What square did you grow up in?
Oh, I lived in East Somerville. So kind of near Sullivan Square in Charlestown, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're rough and tumble.
What's that?
You're rough and tumble?
Please, I was the people that the rough and tumbled over. I was like the punching bag. I was what you call a nerd, and was beaten up. No, I was
Joe. The only fight Joe was in is one of the really tough guys picked Joe up and used him as a weapon to beat another kid with. I think that counts as a fight. Yeah, that's the one fight you were in.
Yeah, that's a tag team win, Joe.
I know. Hey, you know what? It made me build character.
That one does.
Yeah, and CTE probably. I don't know. We'll find out soon enough.
Will you start getting?
So when did you get into comedy?
deflecting. But yeah, I mean, the guys like you who've been doing it after the pandemic and all these places go away, was it a thing where, oh, I got to go find places, or people like, I got to find places, you know, ways to get fannies in the door? How did it work coming out of the pandemic?
It's a little bit of both. It's been a little bit of both. I started the place in Manchester at Murphy's Tap Room, and that led to Murphy's Tap Room in Bedford, where I do shows here and there. It's usually the way it goes. You just kind of, I mean, I've never been somebody who went out and just kind of pounded the pavement. What I've noticed since the pandemic in Boston has been that, like, right now everybody's starting shows because it's so easy. And I see, like, I see stuff come across my social media feed, and I just look at it and I'm like, these guys have the best comedians in Boston for $10 Saturday night. The best comedians for $10? They must be great.
There should be a law, like, against false advertising. The best comedians. Like, wait a second. Is this peer-reviewed? Can we get a second opinion on this best?
It's so subjective. And I see this all the time. And I saw somebody there are certain things I don't feel that I should be mentioning, but there are things that drive me crazy. I will tell you one, these fundraisers that aren't actually fundraisers, you know, where it's like, you know, $5 of every dollar five of every 20 goes to the cause, or five of every 25. And those kind of, but you know, I'm just an old man screaming, get off my lawn.
You know, somebody pointed this out who I thought was fascinating. The lower price of show. So if a husband, you know, is taking the wife out and it's a $5 show, and the show sucks, he's the cheap bastard. He's on the hook. Like, this is a one night out and this is the best you could do. If you pay 25, 30, 40 bucks and the show isn't great, well, that it's a comedian who sucks, you know? And it was funny because, you know, it's another booker who's like, yeah, I wouldn't do a show under $20, $25 only because, and there's so many places that approach them and they're like, oh, we can do this and we can have these cheap things. And this is like, no, actually the more you can charge, first of all, the better crowd you're going to get. Cause you know, if anybody can be a heckler or whatever for $5 or a free show, but if you're paying 30 bucks and you're driving a half hour to see a show, you're invested. You have something at stake and you're there to laugh.
I think that that's true. Although I got to say it's heckling has become a bigger issue after 2020. I was walking somebody out of a show and I didn't, you know, it's not up to me to throw people out because I just can't do that. But I said to somebody enough times, can you guys shut up, that they left. They were mad at me. And it was women, which is not touching. Part of the story. Well, it is part of the story. There were women and they were all upset with me. And they say, this is supposed to be a performance. And I say, yeah, it's a performance. And you're not letting them talk. And how can he perform if you won't shut up? But I didn't say quite loud like that because they were out the door. And at that point I was going to take the win.
Right.
But in my head, I'm like, what is wrong with you? But this is how people are right now. It's I think some of them have just been in too long. And some of them just, it's like they forgot, not all, but some people have just forgotten how to act. So unfortunately, it's worse than before 2020. Yep.
College professors and friends that we have said the same thing, that kids were home, you know, especially the kids who got to college who missed half their junior year and their senior year. They get to college and they forget how the social norms work.
Well, what I'm talking is more with older adults who come to comedy shows and less with kids. I have seen with kids, I think the rise of social media has come at the same time that the 2020, and my daughter was in high school during this, during 2020, or she was in, I guess, the end of middle school into high school. So it was hard. It was hard for everybody.
Yeah, my son, I think my son is, I have a son who's about your daughter's age, and they had the drive-by graduation ceremony from middle school. It was kind of like, hey, remember us when we weren't sick? Here, we're still here, you know? And yeah, they kind of, right, they had that sort of weird shift. But you know what? I mean, I don't know. I think people just stopped giving a fuck. I don't know. Like, I don't know what it is. It's just like.
I think that, well, let's put it this way, two different issues, but I think for the kids going to school, they had a rough couple of years, and they've got to hopefully adjust. And, you know, the MCAS scores in Massachusetts, standardized tests have gone down for 5 or 6 straight years. So hopefully that's going to turn around. And students generally not, you know, you can't speak for all of them, but if you're speaking generally, I think some of the students – generally, students are not quite as studious as they used to be, but they're getting there. And they're all still basically smart kids, and that's not going to change. But yeah, I think your kid and my daughter, I think they were knocked off the pegs a little bit. And I think they're going to readjust, and it's going to be okay.
Yes. As for
comedy audiences, who knows?
Yeah. I think, you know what it is? I think comics are interrupting these audience members' viral TikTok shows. You know, like, hey, we're filming here. We got a permit as well, and, you know.
Yeah, everybody wants to be the viral star for being an acid show. Okay, as a dad, your daughter comes to you and says, hey, I kind of like what you do. Would you be encouraging for her to go down this path, or would you be like, please, I beg of you?
My daughter works for me.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so she's seen comedians in action. She's seen comedians before shows, after shows, during shows, and she has no desire to be a comedian. My niece, on the other hand, has done pretty well. She's I haven't seen her for a while, but she was in New York, and she was from New Hampshire. She won a contest at UNH. And I hooked her up with a few people, and she wound up opening for Justin McKinney at theaters for a while. And she did the Hampton Beach Comedy Festival, and she started working a lot around Boston, then went to New York. And, you know, she's taken some of my advice, and she hasn't taken other advice from me, and she's doing all right, both personally and professionally.
I think we've had some people on in your position who've said the biggest thing that they've seen that's changed is Boston has this reputation since the 80s, the number of performers and just icons and writers and all that stuff, but it's mostly been men. But over the past like 10 years, there's more and more, you know, just, you know, older, middle age, like just women coming through the system, coming through Boston. And now it's getting a really great reputation as being a not a women comic city, but there's lots. Like, I just saw a show, and it was a great venue. It was in a really nice place in Lowell, the auditorium, and it was Plummer and Jen Howell. And I don't know if I've been to a better show in the last 6 months.
So you know? Funny, nobody ever mentions Carolyn Plummer's first name. It's always Plummer.
Carolyn Plummer. She is just, I've seen her a couple times, but that night it was the two of them. It was so great. I mean, it was, and like, of course, you know, Christine Hurley is just on another level. I don't think she's had a bad show in 20 years, you know.
I think Christine's great. I think Carolyn's great. I think Kelly Mack is great.
Yep.
I think there are a lot of great female comedians who've, I wouldn't say that they've necessarily paved the way. I think it's almost a thing where you want to look at them and you want to just look at all the individuals. And I don't think necessarily that there was a, I'm not sure that there were any barriers to entry that stopped other women from advancing in stand-up. I mean, you'd have to talk to, I know sometimes women feel that way. Some individual women have felt that way, but I've also known comedians who feel like they're not getting ahead, and it's got more to do with them not being as funny as the next person than it does to have them doing, whether or not they're males or females or whatever. But I think you better look at the women who are getting work, and they're the funniest women, basically.
Yeah. Emily Rosowski.
Yep.
I'm trying to, She I was on a show with her, and my wife, like, she had one bit that I don't know if a comedian ever had something that my wife almost felt it was written for her and her three friends who were there. And she was just like, wow, please, you know, she's like, you know, try to get more shows with her so I can not so I can bring my friends to your shows, Jack. Try to get shows with her so we can go see you. Because she absolutely, you know, then there's a Sarah Poulin, like I said, Jen Howell. I mean, there's more and more. And I don't know if it was just the stigma of a boys club, but it is great that, you know, you see more and more lineups where it's not me, you, and Joe. You know what I mean? Right.
I mean, not like Jacques' show last night. I mean, that was just Sausage Fest 2024. Yeah.
It's like, honestly, you know, everybody's filing in. It was a Smitty show in Tilton. Great crowd. It was great crowd, 90 plus people. But I'm looking around like, are we storming the Capitol after this? Because there seems to be a lot of crackers and, you know, like a Cracker Barrel inside a Smitty's, you know, movie theater. You know, Dave, you know, I promise we wouldn't take your whole afternoon, but I just want to quickly end on a couple things. Like, so what do you have coming up, you know, personally, pretty soon? And what over, like, the next couple of years are you hoping to see happen with your career as a performer and your career as a producer?
The Dave Radigan Incorporated Scamps Comedy has got the I think one of the biggest things we've got coming up. I'm just looking at the shows. There's a show at the Tackle Box Brewery in Marlboro this Friday, and then we've got a couple of fundraisers, which are, I have two fundraisers that I guess are going to do 300 people apiece. So that's good. One for the Plastow Lions Club, and then I don't want to go into all the fundraisers because that gets busy and I'll forget somebody. But I've got, for me personally, I've got nothing but fundraisers pretty much for the next few months until the fall. I am in Manchester at Murphy's on the 13th, which is a Saturday coming up. So that's one. And for Scamps Comedy, the other big thing we've got coming up is on Mother's Day. This is a new trend, Mother's Day comedy brunches. And I've got one in Marlboro at the Apex Entertainment, and I've got another one at Ryan Amusements down in the South Shore. And in Hanover, and those are kind of a new thing and kind of a fun thing. The first one we did was in Marlboro last year. We got a big crowd, almost all females, mothers bringing their daughters, bringing their mothers out.
That's great.
Three female comedians, all really funny. And so that's what we got coming up at Scamps Comedy. Beyond that, you know, there's the Hampton Beach Comedy Festival this summer at Hampton Beach. And there are the usual shows and as many places as we can put them.
That is fantastic. Joe, did you figure out who Peter Brady's secret identity was?
I don't know. I know. Remember, he played Benedict Arnold. Oh, and then is there a character? Is there a character that, I guess he had a twin or something like that, a non-related twin named Arthur Owens. No, if that rings a bell. I don't remember, though. I've seen every episode of...
Well, we're going to have to go back and do our research. Gosh.
At some point, I'll run into Gary, and I'll ask him, because I bet he still knows.
That's fantastic.
George Glass, is it? Because that was Jan Brady's
That was Jan Brady's fake boyfriend. Was Jan... Oh, Jan, okay, George Glass.
So a long time ago. Maybe I got it wrong. But...
Dave, who, you're on a desert island, you can pick four comedy albums. If you don't remember the comedy album title, that's okay. Who are the four comedians you could listen to for eternity?
Wow. Well, Dave Chappelle, Dave Chappelle's fantastic. John Mulaney, I like. You know, obviously I like a lot of the Boston guys, so we'll just say all the Boston guys. Right in there.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I mean, let's just say Justin McKinney and Bob Marley and Jimmy Dunn and Tony V and Paul Narduzzi and Paul D'Angelo and anybody I forgot. We'll just put them all in a big group. But the four, I would say, national guys are Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock I like, John Mulaney I like a lot. I really like Taylor Tomlinson. I see her stuff all the time, and she's really funny. Trying to think if there's anybody, you know, there are a lot of other people that I like, but mostly I just listen to it and pass by it. I went to a Chappelle concert, which is the first time that I've gone to see a comedian that I wasn't on a show with in probably 25 years. Wow. And it was interesting because it was so different. And I'm actually sitting there, and I watch stuff on TV all the time, but just to actually go live. But he was great. And he's always, you know, and I know he's controversial somewhat, which I think it makes him interesting to me, but I also think he's thoughtful, and his comedy frequently goes in places I don't expect it to go in, which is, you know, one of the things we talked about when you talked about sometimes women will see women and they'll relate to them in ways. There's two kinds of recognition in comedy you want. You want the, that's exactly the way I've always felt about something. And then you want the, I've never thought of it that way, but that's really interesting.
Yeah.
And those two things you always want in comedy. And I think those comedians are people who deliver on that. Who's your favorite comedian?
If I'm doing it, I think both Joe and I are very, very old souls. The Steve Martin albums, you know, I grew up just playing those till like the needle wore out type thing. I don't think a day goes by that Joe and I don't quote the button down mind of Bob Newhart.
Yeah.
Probably Don Rickles. And then, you know, somewhere in there is like, Patton Oswalt, Tom Papa, Brian Regan, and my wife. I think my wife saw John Mulaney 6 or 7 times when he did his residency at the Wilbur Theater, getting ready for that show. So we love him.
I'll throw in Anthony Jeselnik and Jim Gaffigan.
Oh yeah.
I just want to ask you a question. You heard the question, right?
Yeah.
For Jack.
Yeah.
What comedian do you like? One. Did you notice it was the same one?
You're asking the wrong person for one answer. He's the guy who yells 5 answers at a Jeopardy question, and then it's like, I got it right. Yeah. I told you.
Is he that person in Trivial Pursuit says, it's not Kevin McHale. No, Kevin McHale. I didn't think it was. I had a buddy who's a well-known Boston Celtics writer who used to do that in Trivial Pursuit. I won't say his name to rat him out, but it's Mark Murphy. anyway, so Joe, you're in a parking lot. You're in your car. You're
crying.
Crying, and you want to
cheer up a bit.
Thank you. That's the word. Who do you put on?
You know what? I got to say that now Bill Burr might be like one of the. He's just like. I mean, his podcast, his comedy, even if his acting, like, it's just like, whatever he's in, a sketch comedy, when he was on Saturday Night Live, God. I mean, yeah, but his stand-up is just great. So, yeah, I'm a Bill Burr fan.
He really is great. He's a good guy. I actually spent a few days in Ireland with him at the Cat Laughs Comedy Festival in Kilkenny, Ireland. And I didn't know him very well, but I ran into him in a castle, and we went for a tour together. And he knew the guys I was with, so he hung out with us, and he came to a couple of our shows, and he actually closed one of our shows.
Oh.
It was interesting to watch him work, because he was taking all those references of everything he had seen in Ireland, and he was incorporating them into his routine, sort of like he did later that year in Philadelphia.
Oh my God,
yes.
That famous YouTube video.
That's what broke him. Yeah, that's what made him the big big-time star.
Yeah, and it's
8 more minutes.
He's a good guy. What are we looking for? What?
When he was counting down, and he's like
3 more minutes. That was so funny. That was so funny. His reception in Ireland was a lot nicer than that.
I was in Kilkenny with our family in like 2013. When we got there, I think Bruce Springsteen either was going to play or had just played the town, because. All over the town were like posters like, welcome, Bruce. We love you, Bruce. And it was just like, what? Where?
It's a big festival place. I guess they do really well for a tourism business on the weekends. Hmm. And that's really all I remember about it. It was 17.
I mean, you were in Ireland. I'm surprised you remember anything. I took a tour of the Guinness factory when I was there.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of what I can share. I know at one point we were in an after party, and I'm not saying who started it. I can't tell you who it was. But somebody, one of the Irish comedians had too much to drink and passed out and started throwing popcorn in his hair. He had a lot of hair. And so by the end of the night, there was a lot of popcorn in his hair. He sat there. And like we'd come by and we'd be, oh, this is so wrong. And then throw some more popcorn.
As long as it wasn't like cigarette ashes or anything like that. Like butts out.
No court comedians were injured in the after party.
Well, happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody. I mean, you know, that's a good note to end on. We were recording this on St. Patrick's Day.
So, Dave, your handles, you don't really do the Dave Redican thing. It's Scamps Comedy across all the socials, correct?
I do both. Dave Redican and Scamps Comedy. And, across both the socials, Scamps Comedy is what I spend most of my time on, but all my Dave Redican stuff forwards either directly to me or to Scamps Comedy. So
I can't thank you enough for carving out time on a Saturday to talk to us. It's been a long time coming. I'm very much, you know, looking forward to meeting in person because that hasn't happened yet. And Joe, you got any final thoughts, my friend?
I didn't have any beginning thoughts, but I would like to say that, thanks for coming on our little podcast. And don't worry about, like, ratting anybody out because nobody listens to this. This is talk about, like, unpaid charity work, what you did for this past hour. I mean, I think I'll mail you the dick bucks for the services rendered. But, thanks for coming on.
I usually approach guests who coming on and I say, this is kind of a make-a-wish thing for me, you know, I don't know how much time I have.
I was in, I did a crime and grime podcast for about a year, and we were like 96th or 97th percentile of listenership. And you know what I found out that means? Nothing. Nothing. You made no money unless you're the 99 point something, 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 something.
Right. So
it's, thank you for having me on a little podcast that nobody will listen to except for
my mom will catch
Jack's
you.
Mom. Yeah.
My mom will catch she'll feel guilty about the money again. She won't give you the money.
Oh,
but she'll feel guilty about it. But
I was going to give Dave the vig for like shaking her down for the like. You're going to feel so guilty. If I get any money, expect like a $10 check to arrive in the mail.
Dick bucks, I'm sure. All right, guys. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Oh, Jacques, don't forget.
I live in Beverly, Massachusetts. That's where I'm living. That's my hometown. I'm back there. I haven't always lived there. I was in New York City for a while, and I moved back because I was so successful. Here's the thing. I love living back in my hometown, but when we left New York City, man, we were so broke, and it is hard when you are broke because you can't find help. Like, I read the newspaper, the Financial Advisor column. Have you read this? Dear Financial Advisor, I've nearly paid off my $1 million home. I have $750,000 in diversified investments. Do you have any advice for me? Signed, puzzled but extremely comfy. Dear puzzled, bite me. My entire financial plan is trying to make sure my father doesn't spend all of his money before he dies. I know that's Steve's plan too, Mr. Katsos. We were talking about it in the green room. If I was ever going to write to that financial advisor, I'd write, Dear Financial Advisor, I make $65,000 a year. I've got $95,000 in credit card debt. I'm thinking about robbing a bank. Dear Dave, that bank robbery thing, probably your best bet. Maybe you'll get caught, then you'll have a place to stay. Thanks very much, everybody. Thank you very much. Soft tones.
I find myself without your charms.